Welcome to The Edges of Lean. I'm Bella Engelbach, and in this podcast, we explore the human and creative side of lean thinking, unusual places where lean thinking is practiced. We meet people who are practicing continuous improvement in many different flavors and styles. So come along with me on a journey to the edges of lean. Episode 4, Learning Leadership in the Cockpit of an F-15. I met Brandon Williams a few months ago, and we couldn't come from more different professional backgrounds. And you know what? I think he'd be the last person to describe himself as a lean thinker or as being involved in continuous improvement. I call this podcast The Edges of Lean because I want to explore the whole universe of the kind of thinking I call lean thinking. As Brandon and I were talking, I realized that what he is practicing and teaching is a way of being that is very much like what I call lean. Especially when we think about lean as a way of leading and developing people. In a world where lean thinkers look to Toyota as the North Star for developing and leading an organization, we might never think to look in the cockpit of an F-15 fighter jet to find a lean leader.
Because when you lead people, it's the same thing, right? I mean, no matter what business you're in or environment you work in, we face complexities. I mean, you know me flying an F-15, but you're facing a lot of challenge and obstacles moving very fast.
Brandon Williams is the CEO and founder of LeadTech, a leadership development firm. Brandon is an accomplished and results-oriented leader, a top business speaker, an executive consultant, and technical expert with proven leadership experience in managing cross-functional teams and organizations. His experiences as a United States Air Force F-15E fighter pilot and officer, leading diverse teams of men and women from all backgrounds, set the stage for his leadership methodology on leading high-performing teams. Brandon received a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from the United States Air Force Academy and a Master of Aeronautical Science in Aviation Management from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Brandon Williams, thank you very much for being on The Edges of Lean. Can you tell me a little bit about how you decided long ago that you wanted to go to a service academy, which I think is what really took you down this path?
Yeah, Bella, sure. And thank you very much for having me on. Always love and excited to have a medium to talk about leadership and pass on some of those lessons. So thank you. I think it all goes back to when I was a little boy, or as long as I can remember at least, I have always wanted to be a pilot. In particular, I always wanted to grow up and be a fighter pilot. I was part of the what they call the Top Gun generation. So, you know, I was in, I think, third or fourth maybe when the original Top Gun movie came out. And I'll never forget, I think my cousins, or somebody took me to them because my mom wouldn't let me go see it because obviously some of the language is a little older than probably I should have seen. I remember going to see that movie and just thinking, man, this is the coolest thing in the world. This is what I want to do. Like this is awesome. And so for as long as I can remember, I've wanted to be a pilot, in particular fighter pilot. So that's kind of what I set my goals on when I was young and just always kept looking towards that. And as I got older into high school, you know, I found out about the service academies. Actually, when I was in grade school still, my mom actually took me and my brother on a trip to Colorado. And we actually went out to the Air Force Academy just as a, you know, as visitors, having no idea that one day I would go there. And I do remember that trip briefly, barely, but I remembered it. And then, so just coming up through high school, you know, I started looking at all my options, and to be a pilot, you know, going into the military made sense, obviously. And I'd always wanted to, my dad was in the military for a brief time. I have a brother that was in the military, grandfathers that were in the military. So I'd always also had a natural inclination to want to go serve. And so it just all made sense. And so I said, well, why not, you know, try to go to a, look at a service academy. And I looked at Air Force and Navy, obviously because of the flying opportunities, and got accepted to the Air Force Academy, got accepted to several ROTC programs at universities, and ultimately decided to go to the Air Force Academy. So that's what led me there.
Wow. I ended up where I am, actually, because of my love for Jacques Cousteau, and how that connects to what I do now is a very long
story. It's funny how life, it's funny the curves that life takes us on, isn't it?
Exactly. So you went to the Air Force Academy. You graduate obviously as a pilot and you know, an officer and a gentleman, and right. And in the service academy, I imagine you were already learning about leadership. And what were you learning then?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one thing with all the businesses I've been working with for several years now. The one thing that always, when I first started doing my consulting and speaking work, that really, really shocked me about the business world and corporate America and just any other organizations that, that we'd worked with. I used to have this idea that all these business leaders just had it figured out. I mean, if you'd made it pretty high in a company and to an extremely high leadership role, I mean, you clearly had it figured out. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of smart people in those roles. But what really shocked me, some of the questions they would ask me about leadership, you know, things around accountability or motivation or communication or getting teams to do things or, you know, decision-making, just some things that I think in the military I took for granted that, you know, we are ingrained with those leadership skill sets, or start learning those, I should say, start molding those, start being mentored on those at a very, very young age. And it goes back to your question about the academy. You know, my very first time there, I'll never forget my first memory. Your family drops you off at what's called the visitor or the Association of Graduates, essentially the alumni center that they have there. And the alumni center kind of helps your, you know, navigate you through, and you say your goodbyes to your parents, and then you get on this bus and you take about this 5 or 10 minute quiet bus ride up to what we call the Cadet Hill. And this is the main cadet area. And now you're separated from your family, your all reality, and now the rest of your life starts to take on. And the minute you get off that bus, it's the classical, you know, upperclassmen yelling in your face, you know, telling you what to do, throwing you into that environment of extreme confusion, not chaos, not really knowing where to go. And it's all for a reason, obviously, right? You know, they're getting you to think under pressure, make decisions under pressure. So that's the very first taste you get of it. But in terms of more specific leadership, what I found was within just a few days, you know, you're just a brand new, what they call a 4-degree, which is essentially a freshman. And you got to go through basic cadet training. So basically basic training, approximately 6 weeks or so before the school year even starts. But those first few days, what I noticed is, even though they really give us much responsibility, they did start to give us little doses of it. And that's those little exposure to leadership. What do I mean by that? Well, you know, say they wanted us in the hallway or wanted us in a certain formation by a certain time, all wearing the exact same uniform. They may only tell one or two of us, right? But what do they expect? They expect that one or two of us to communicate that to our rest of our team, which was probably about 30 or 40 other basic cadets or so. But they expect us to communicate that and have all of us in one spot ready to go with the same exact uniform. And guess what? If you weren't the same or somebody was late, that was not a good day, right? So But I guess what I get by that is that they increase that responsibility, right? More and more and more to where, let's fast forward now, by your second year, so your sophomore year, you're a 3-degree. Now you're the one responsible for training all those new 4-degrees, those new freshmen coming in. And you just left that phase. So very quickly, now you're responsible. By the time you're a 2-degree, a junior, now you're essentially in what's called a cadet leadership role. And then by the time you're what's called as a firstie, a senior, you are the leaders of the academy. I mean, they have a big saying that at the Air Force Academy that, yes, we have officers, obviously, that are in charge there, that oversee the training, our instructors, all that, you know. But the cadets really do run the academy. And those are the senior cadets. So think, you know, what, 21, maybe 22 years old.
Wow.
I mean, one of my job, when by the time I was a firstie, I was selected to be what's called a cadet squadron commander. So in addition to an extremely rigorous academic schedule and physical fitness, you know, I have to maintain a certain physical fitness standards and all the other things that go along with the military academy, I was responsible essentially for leading as a cadet about 100 other or more other cadets, all junior classmen and other seniors. So imagine that kind of responsibility for a college-aged a kid. So, you know, from the very beginning, that very first day as a new recruit, you start getting exposed to it. And you start getting a little bit of taste of leadership as you go on all the way up until your senior year. Now you're in a full-up, and I mean, they call it a leadership lab because you're not really an officer, but you're in this leadership laboratory where you're essentially leading other cadets and getting a taste of that. And the beauty of that is it gives you a little bit of a chance to stumble, a little bit of a chance to stub your toe, learn some lessons about what leadership is, what good leadership is, what bad leadership is, before you go out to the real world, or the real Air Force, as we used to say, as a brand new second lieutenant.
So it's intentional.
Oh, yeah.
It's very intentional, and it's also, you know, as we say in the lean world, it's about small experiments, at least initially. You're starting with small experiments and you're getting instant feedback, it sounds like, about your efforts.
Right. And along the way, you know, we're also having, you know, one main difference of the military academy, obviously, is in addition to normal academic classes that you would see at other schools, we also had what was called professional military education. So we would have essentially classes on military history, but you also have a lot of classes on just leadership. You know, leadership theory, you know, how to lead, and just so many different leadership ideas, because the whole purpose is to train you to be an officer. Obviously, a large part of that is the education you receive. You know, the military wants their leaders to be highly educated. So, mm-hmm. But they're training you to be an officer. That's the ultimate end state. It's not for you to leave with a degree, although you do a degree, obviously. But the reason the taxpayers are paying your education is for you to be a leader of other people in the military.
You became a F-15E fighter pilot. So what is that like? What is an F-15E, and what's it like? What kind of experience is that?
Yeah, so after the Air Force Academy, I was selected to go to Air Force pilot training, which is another extremely rigorous, approximately, by the time you show up, do all your academics, flying, everything is complete, probably about a 15-month process or so. And then you have more follow-on training from that. So after completing that, yes, I was selected to go to fly the F-15E, which was what I wanted to fly as my first choice. So I was very happy about that. But it is a two-seat, twin-engine, air-to-air and air-to-ground fighter aircraft for the Air Force, in a way to sum it up. Obviously a very capable, high performance jet fighter aircraft, capable of many, many things. It has a crew of two. So we also have a weapons systems officer or weapons systems operator that sits, in the jet as well, in addition to the pilot, which is the role I played. But, doing that, you know, again, in that environment, I always think back to, you know, when I was young, still in my young to mid 20s. And jumping in that airplane, $50 million piece of military hardware equipment, and very low experience. I mean, I was trained, but I still had low experience. Like anything else, you know, the first time you do something, you're probably trained, but you still have a low experience level. But to go in that environment and for the military, the Air Force, and my leadership to give me that autonomy, that responsibility to go out and execute a mission where I was going to be separated, you know, for sometimes hours at a time from any kind of leadership authority. And they expected me to make decisions in a very, very dynamic environment where things can change very, very quickly, whether it's, you know, things internal to your cockpit. So issues with the aircraft, I mean, things can go wrong, having trusting you to deal with those complications, those emergencies, or things as simple as weather and dealing with that, or, you know, dealing with other aircraft out there. I mean, oftentimes we're always going out with other formation members. So as a flight lead, I was responsible for leading them as well in these dynamic environments.
Wow.
And so that's where I got the idea for actually my company, LeadTAC, was, you know, when I considered all the training and all of our procedures and everything that we had over the years have learned in military aviation, leading up to the culmination to where I was at the time, I was like, man, if you know, how we can harness and think about all the human factors and put a human in an environment like that and have them succeed. I mean, 250 switches, dials, and displays, taking in all the variables, not to mention the physical aspect of flying an airplane that can pull faster or pull up more than 9 Gs.
What does that feel like, 9 Gs?
Well, imagine this, you know, your head weighs about what, 8 or 10 pounds, you know, human head, roughly somewhere around there. So under 9 Gs, multiply that by 9, you know, 90 pounds, close to 100 pounds. So you can imagine the weight on your body. I mean, it's you are drained after an intense sortie sometimes, not to mention the mental exhaustion of trying to comprehend everything, you know, so fast. So, but it's all about human factors. And all of our training, everything we do is all about how humans respond to certain actions, how we take in information, how we process information, how we prioritize, how we make decisions, how we utilize our teams, how we maintain our situational awareness, as we call it. Everything we did was centered around human factors. And that's where I got the idea for LeadTAC, was saying, hey, if I could take the study of human factors, you know, knowing what I know about it now, I teach human factors as well in several schools, and combine that with how we utilize human factors in that world, what it can do in your organizations or businesses. Because when you lead people, it's the same thing, right? I mean, we, no matter what business you're in or environment you work in, we face complexities. I mean, you know, be flying an F-15, but you're facing a lot of challenges and obstacles moving very fast. And the same human factors apply. You know, the way we respond, the way we produce human error, what produces human error, how we can help prevent or mitigate human error. It's all the same. So very, you know, complex task flying an F-15 in extremely dynamic environments. It requires a lot of training, a lot of experience, but mostly of all, it requires a lot of leadership, good leadership. And so, yeah, it was quite an experience, but something that obviously I by far one of the most, probably the culmination of things I will ever do in my life is operating in those kind of environments in terms of challenges and, you know, to my human body.
And that was your 9-year-old dream.
Exactly. Yeah, you're exactly right. So it is, that's the other thing I feel very blessed and fortunate about, is to be able to do something that I always wanted to do since I was a kid, and be able to do that. And then, even now as a major commercial airline pilot, be able to do that, continue some of those skill sets in that world, and then even bring some of that over into what I do now with my leadership development as well, which I thoroughly enjoy too. So very, very, very fortunate to be able to do that, enjoy that.
And congratulations. I mean, that is fantastic. So when you were in the military, you were young, particularly compared, I think, to leaders in other industries. You were young. You were given this huge amount of responsibility. You were learning a lot every day, obviously. And at the same time, you're still living in the world that the rest of us live in. And I know you talk about high reliability organizations, but you probably were also interacting with organizations that were perhaps not such high reliability organizations. So what was going through your mind then as you were operating in both worlds.
Well, you know, the thing about that, it's a my wife often gives me a hard time about this because it's a blessing and a curse a little bit. Because once you come from an organization like that, and I love to use the term high reliability organization, which for those that aren't familiar that are listening, that basically describes an organization in which, despite the very complex, dynamic and dangerous environment they operate in, their mishap rates, their damages to their systems, whatever they operate in, is extremely low. And it really goes back because they're obsessed almost with human error and how to mitigate that. Other examples of that, just for reference, would be the medical industry, nuclear power industry, a lot of times the oil industry, working on oil rigs and out in the water and things like that, in addition to commercial aviation and flying organizations. So just so everyone knows, that's really what we're talking about. We talk about high reliability organizations. But the problem is, like I said, the curse and the bless is the curse and the blessing with that is, in one sense, no matter what you do, you kind of carry that obsession. So when you leave that organization, like I did, so no matter if it's, you know, I'm doing work outside my house or I'm helping my kids with their schoolwork, some of that obsession, I hate to call it perfectionism, but some of that right? obsession of always eliminating and trying to mitigate human error and thinking about all those what ifs that could go wrong, it really never leaves you. The curse of that, though, is just that. You know, it's kind of hard to let it go sometimes. So there are certain situations when maybe you don't have to be on your toes as much. I mean, when you're playing a game with your kids, you know, you can probably let some of the human error stuff go. I mean, you know, just kind of let some of that perfectionism slip out. But it really does become ingrained. It becomes a way of life for you because that's how you operated for so long. That's how you perform at such a high level and your team did it so long. And so when you would intermingle with other organizations or work with other organizations that maybe don't really have that level of obsession with human error for whatever reason, for various reasons, obviously, then it does frustrate you a little bit, but you have to realize that, you know, not all the, maybe they haven't been exposed to that. They haven't been exposed to a world where mistakes really can mean the difference between life and death. I mean, that sounds a little cliche, but it's so true in high reliability organizations. Human error really can lead to horrible, horrible outcomes. I mean, the commercial aviation industry had to learn it the hard way. If you remember back in the 70s and 80s, there was a string of just major, commercial airline accidents where lots of lives were lost. And that industry, the industry I'm in now, we learned then, hey, we got to do something because we can't have this happen. I mean, these accidents were completely preventable because of chain of human error events led up to them. And so when you get in that world, though, it's hard to get out. It's hard to, you know, release that sometimes. And again, that goes back to why I really started this business and came up with this methodology, Human Factors Leadership, is because when I started working with business leaders and speaking with them and getting into that world, I found that a lot of times there just wasn't that idea that it's almost accepted a lot of times, I think, that you can let accountability fall through the cracks. We, you know, well, people are just going to drop the ball. That's just the way it is. You know, we're going to win some, we're going to lose some, which, you know, I get that. You can't always be, you know, paranoid about everything, but I just always thought there was a better way to lead teams, a better way to incorporate that for leaders.
In the lean community, we look a lot at safety. And if you go into an organization that really has adopted a lean culture, one of the things that you will often see, and then you'll hear it be very visible, will be a focus on safety. You know, mm-hmm. obviously employee safety that's appropriate. Safety for, you know, safety for customers as well. And depending on the industry, then, you know, there may be more or less of that. When Paul O'Neill started as the CEO of Alcoa, he would ask employees if anyone came to work to get injured that day or to die at work. And of course, no one would raise a hand. Investors were horrified, although it quickly became clear that focusing on safety improved the culture and allowed ideas to be heard and acted on, which improved innovation and profitability. It would seem to me that even though when you're laser-focused on safety, that as a leader, you also have to pay attention to other factors. In the military, You have missions to complete in commercial aviation. It's still a business. How do you help leaders manage that balance?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. And first of all, I love what you're talking about with the lean methodology and ideas about the quote of, well, nobody shows up to work to say I'm going to get hurt today, or nobody shows up to work expecting to make a mistake necessarily, right? And I always talk, this kind of will lead into the question you just asked, but something I always like to talk about in my talks is when I work with a lot of these business leaders and I hear things like, well, we just got some bad apples on this team. And I always ask, I'm like, well, what are bad apples really? Dig a little deeper. Tell me about these bad apples. Well, they just kind of seem to lose interest, or they, don't really want to be engaged, or they don't really, seem to want to put a lot of effort in, or just disinterested, or not really a team player. You hear a bunch of different answers. But what that really goes back to, I mean, because rarely, just like your example of rarely do people want to get hurt, rarely in our professional lives does anybody show up to work and say, you know what, I'm just going to do a bad job today. You know what, I'm just not going to be a team player today. I don't want to follow procedures. I'm going to willfully violate our standards. Nobody, I mean, give or take, I don't want to say always, but rarely does that ever happen. Bad apples really are those human factors, those human errors that have taken over. So complacency, lack of communication, lack of awareness, social norms. We can talk all day about these human factors, human errors. I mean, there's 12 most common ones that was coined in the aviation safety world. They call the Dirty Dozen, which seem to always be present. But that's really what those bad apples are. And to eliminate that complacency or those other things, to answer your question, when we have so many different things going on, you're talking about you focus on, maybe one thing, or where, leadership I always say is like spinning plates. Say you've got 10 or 15 plates spinning. Well, you can't focus on one, right? Because what happens? The other ones start to wobble, but you got to keep going around. Well, you may get to one that you see is wobbling more than the others. You may have to spend a few more seconds on that one, but you got to keep going around to the other ones. And what that really comes back to is situational awareness. And what I mean by that is we often succumb to focusing on one of those plates for too long that we think is that's the most critical thing, when it's really not, maybe. But for whatever reason, we just want to focus on one thing. And that's human nature. We get tunnel vision sometimes on one thing that we shouldn't. That's how we're wired at. Again, human factors. It's how our brains are wired. We want to focus on one thing. That's what we're good at. If I'm hungry, what's my number one priority? Got to find food. That's all I am worried about at that one moment. That's a very simple example, but that's how our brains are wired. It's survival instincts, all this different kind of stuff you can talk about. But situational awareness is combating that. Situational awareness is where we really take a deliberate step to really see what all those variables are affecting us. So instead of just focusing on that one metric or that one aspect or that one, thing in our business or our team that we think is important, we continue bringing in all those different variables, whether it's external variables, internal variables, mental states, physical states, I mean, everything that affects us in that moment. And situational awareness, what that really does, what you'll see when you have high situational awareness, you'll notice that you can start to kind of project or predict what's coming next. And when you can get to that point as a leader, that is critical. Not that you're never going to always have high situational awareness. You're going to have low, you're going to have high. I mean, it's like good days and bad days, right? But you're always striving to maintain that situational awareness. And how do we do that? Several ways. One of the best ways I like to sum it up is I call it healthy paranoia. And what does that mean? It's just kind of this idea in the back of your mind that, you're never just completely complacent. You're always thinking, okay, we seem to be going pretty good right now. Everything is calm, but what could go wrong? Because now's the time when things are, one of those ideas, when it rains, it pours, right? Now is the time when something could happen. You just never know. The example I always give is, flying straight and along, level, clear day, on a cloud in the sky, flying an airplane, on autopilot, things are probably pretty good, right? But what am I doing in the back of my mind? I've always got a little tit going, hey, if an engine fails now, what am I going to do? if we start to see this happen, what am I going to do? Hey, there's weather about 200 miles ahead. We need to start thinking about what we're going to go around it. Are we going to do, go over this? What are we going to do? And the same thing with your business, same thing with your organizations. Always taking in, always thinking, what have we missed? What are we not thinking about? And it's not just about your business, it's about your people too, to your point. Always having situational awareness of your people, of their fatigue, their stress. What is your awareness of them? Are they, and I'm not talking about just their work life, and you don't have to get personal with people, but just little things of just knowing about what's going on in their life. Maybe they have a sick kid at home. Maybe they have a father that's in the hospital. Maybe they, they're having some issues at home. You don't have to ask them personally, but if they start to talk to you about it, just talk to them, show empathy. It's human stuff. This is not rocket science about, getting to know people. And I think a lot of times we miss that because of your point. We stay so focused on, the end state, the end goal of whatever task it is we're trying to accomplish that day or project. And we really forget to take in all those other variables. Because guess what? That project or task you're leading, 9 times out of 10, those other people on your team, they've got other stuff going on. I'm talking professionally. They got probably got 10, 15 other things on their plate. So that's not the only thing they're thinking about. But it's
Right.
critical as leaders that we take a deliberate step to take in that situational awareness and really of our teams, of our people, of our organizations, always trying to maintain. It's something you're always doing. And that's, again, something I got from my job as a fighter pilot and a leader, an officer in the military and serving in several leadership roles.
One of the things that I've observed in organizations is a sense of optimism. There's always, we can do it, rah-rah, and that sense of optimism I have found has actually countered what I often talk about, which is we need to be keeping an eye out for problems. And in fact, the job of most of people in the organization at every level is to look for problems and then work on solving those problems. And I have had people say to me, "Oh, well, that's so negative. I don't want to be negative. Let's be positive. Let's be optimistic." And I naturally am a pretty optimistic person myself, so it's easy for me to say yes. I'm just wondering, have you seen that in organizations, where optimism becomes a way of life, and then they lose that healthy paranoia?
Oh yeah, I agree. And a good way to put that what you described, a positive way, or because I like to say I'm an optimist too. I really am. I think I always try to, despite healthy paranoia, there's a difference, right? I mean, there's a difference in cautious optimism versus negativism, right? I mean, there's a
I do.
difference. Cautious optimism is the way I like to look at things. For example, the current world we're in right now. When I talk to people about different aspects of the pandemic, whether it's, the economy, business, or, the world in general, whatever. I always kind of describe things like, well, I'm cautiously optimistic. And here's why, and whatever reasons I'll give. But I like to say it's cautious optimism. And that kind of, you don't have to be negative. I mean, nobody likes a negative person, right? I mean, negative
Right,
energy
yeah.
is bad. And there is a difference between being negative and being cautiously optimistic. Example I love is years ago, a few years ago, not years ago, but probably 5 years ago. So I worked with a company, and I remember talking with some of their leaders, and I said, well, we'll typically go over what their company is about, what they're looking to change, what are some of their issues, and I customize all my events or my engagements with the clients. And I asked them, I said, well, what are some things you're thinking about that might go wrong? How are you increasing your situation awareness? What are you thinking about? And literally the CEO, essentially, I don't know if he's the CEO, president, whatever his title is, top leader of this company was basically like, well, actually, we're just doing great. I mean, things are going good, and we don't really plan to fail. We don't really plan, for things to go wrong. And that kind of attitude, I think, and I think he meant well. It was probably just the way we were talking about the conversation, but that kind of outlook sometimes can be, like, to your point, very detrimental. Because I get it, things are going well. We never plan to fail, obviously. But the other thing with the flip side of that is, do plans ever rarely go according to plan? No. So good leaders, I argue, are always considering what are those things that we're not thinking about? What are those things where this plan could take a curve here? And that all goes back to, again, that situational awareness. That all goes back to not being complacent. And it really all goes back to fighting those human factors, making sure we're keeping that awareness of our surroundings. But it takes a challenge. You know, there's other ways to do it besides healthy paranoia, other ways we can, you know, I help clients work with it. But the idea is always staying on top of your toes, always never becoming succumbing to complacency as you go along and lead your teams.
Brandon Williams, when you and I first met, we talked a little bit about some of the relationships or overlaps between what I call lean thinking and your life experience and what's led you to what you're doing now. And one of the things we talked about was the OODA loop and what you've learned from that. And we talked about the relationship and sort of overlap with what in lean we talk about is the plan, do, check, act cycle. And so I was hoping today you could give us a lesson on the OODA loop and especially on reflection.
Sure. Well, the OODA loop and Observe, Worry, Decide, Act, is there have been books, papers, whole classes probably on this. So there's absolutely no way I'm going to be able to give you or the audience the justice it really deserves. Yeah. But I can definitely give you my two cents on it, the overview. Funny enough, I got a few books sitting right here. So the man responsible for that, John Boyd, highly recommend this book. Boyd, it's all about him and his background and what he did. Obviously, from the picture, you can see he was a fighter pilot back in the day.
Can you give us the title of that book?
Yeah, Boyd, the fighter pilot who changed the art of war.
Okay, great, thanks.
But it's really not about it does go into his military past and his time in the Air Force, but you got to understand with him, yes, he was a fighter pilot. But a lot of his fame, a lot, not fame, but a lot of his popularity, how he really became known, was his later years when he became a senior officer in the Air Force, went to work at the Pentagon. Some of the things he did, his influences, design, really were responsible for the way future generation fighter aircraft were designed. The aircraft fighter, the F-15, the F-16, other aircraft, the whole design idea and what the Air Force wanted really stemmed from a lot of the things that he argued, he taught, he pitched to the air staff at the Pentagon about what the future of air warfare was going to be. But the whole thing behind this, what you really get from him is the way he looked at strategic thinking, more importantly, decision-making. And he came up with this idea and he wrote, he had many talks on it. The problem with Boyd, a lot of the stuff we have to interpret was his writing, and it wasn't always, people had different ways of looking at it. But really what it was this idea of Observe, Orient, Decide, Act, OODA. And his argument was that, you know, people, organizations, everything is a system. We're all in a system. Now that system can be a team, it can be the world, it can be an organization, it can be, you know, an office, it can be, you know, whatever that system is. And the way to operate in that system is this OODA loop. It's this way of thinking. So you observe how this system is affecting you, what the current state is.
Situational awareness.
Or exactly. Orient yourself to which direction you want to go, or orient yourself to the current problem you're seeing within the system. Decide, D, and then you're going to act on that, OODA, the actual action, the decision. And then if you look at other drawings of it, it'll have a loop going right back to that O, which brings in the loop part. And I throw in that A is also, I say act and assess, right? So you act and then you go back, but really the assess is the observe part, because as soon as you act on something, you observe, how has the system changed? Now, this is an extremely simplified way to look at this, but without giving you a whole, you know, doctoral thesis on all this, this is the idea. And his argument was, we call it OODA loop because the argument is, in order to outpace your competition, in order to succeed in a system that's moving very fast, you have to OODA loop faster than the next person. You have to make those decisions, that process going in your brain faster than the next person, the competition, faster than the system, faster than the threat, whatever obstacle you're facing. And that was his whole theory. So this whole, he never intended for this, I don't think, to necessarily go to the business world. And he was just trying to, you know, he was presenting a better way. We study this as fighter pilots because it's really comes out of the crutch of what we do. When you're 1v1 against another aircraft and you're both moving very quickly in a very dynamic environment, who can OODA loop faster? Who can make changes faster to put themselves in a position of advantage, essentially? And same thing in business. And the business world caught on to this. And I'm sure some of your listeners that are listening around probably heard of the OODA loop because it's very common, actually, in a lot of you know, business schools or teaching decision making or anything like that. So when I do some decision making, especially my leadership coaching, I use that basis for a lot of how we make decisions. The other thing I talk about decision making is perception, decision, execution. So in other words, when a decision is made, a lot of times, say a bad decision is made, or we get a negative outcome from a task or project of a team member. Well, what do we typically do as leaders? How traditional ways of thinking have always been, well, I call it blame and train. You know, you just go to that person, hey, you made a bad decision, don't do that again, here's how we do this.
Right.
We don't really analyze the decision. And this idea of perception, decision, execution, you want to look at the perception. Again, going back to that observe and orient, the perception. What was the perception? Did they even perceive the right thing? You know, did they perceive there was a problem? If their perception was off, well, then that's what we need to focus on now. We don't even worry about the decision, because even if they made a decision, their heart was probably in the right place because they just had a bad perception of the situation. So let's fix that. Well, if they did perceive that, then what was their decision? And then you look at that. Well, if we say they made a bad decision, well, then we can work on that. But let's say the perception was good, the decision was good, but the execution was just not up to speed, or the execution was just a little poor. Well, the good thing is their perception and their decision was there. We can fix the execution. I would argue that's the easiest thing to fix is the execution. That's one of those things, again, your heart was in the right place. We just didn't execute it how we wanted to. So that's another way. But that really kind of goes in with the OODA loop as well, that whole perception. It's just another way of really thinking about it. But that's kind of the summary of it. And I think it's a phenomenal way to look at how we make decisions in business, how we make decisions in uncertainty, when especially now in even pre-COVID environment, we are already moving at an extremely rapid pace with the way data comes at us, the way our markets respond. And so it's really about taking that cognitive effort to really observe, orient, decide, and act. And then more importantly, bring that loop back and get that feedback.
I think the challenge though in business culture is about taking that moment to do that thinking, to do that reflection. And it just stopping. I mean, and you're not stopping forever, right? But just stopping that moment for that microsecond, because the focus is on achievement and often dates and we've done something and let's act. And so you'll see, you know, people doing sort of long, tedious lessons learned long after a project.
Yeah.
But really getting into doing it consistently and over and over and over again and doing it quickly is a really hard cultural shift. How do you help organizations with that?
That's a great question. And it is challenging. I mean, let's face it, leadership is tough. Nobody said this is going to be easy, right? The weight of leadership is a big burden to bear. So it's definitely not going to be easy. And I get it. We're always working in execution mode. We're always putting out fires. We don't have time to observe or think about what's really happening. We're just always doing, right? And I get that. And there's different ways. We can talk about time management, even Charlie's different things. But big picture, a few things. Number one, it's like anything else. This takes practice. This takes experience. I mean, you know, as good as I want to be a good golfer, I just argue I'm not a very good golfer, but I keep practicing, keep working at it. I go to the range, I'm getting better. But this is the same thing. I mean, leadership, anything in leadership, you know, takes work, takes skill sets, takes mentoring, takes practice, takes work on your own. You know, I always argue, I'm a big believer that leaders are not born. Now, some of us may be born with certain skill sets that we do better than others that are leadership attributes, such as maybe some of us are good communicators. Maybe some of us are better thinking on our toes. Maybe some of us have better charisma, you name it. But nobody is born, I don't think, with all those attributes of leadership that are just perfect. And leadership is all about developing those skill sets. It's all about developing all those skill sets, practicing them, working on them, working on our decision-making, working on how we observe decisions we've made, getting that feedback, how we do that, whether it's through self-reflection, whether it's with our teams, whether it's with a mentor, you name it. So all those things can help us make those decisions better. But another, more deliberate way I like to talk to my clients about doing this is what I call a human factors debrief. And essentially what that is, you know, when I was in the military and as a fighter pilot, after every mission we did, combat or peacetime, it didn't matter what we did, we always came back and we had a debrief. A debrief on how the mission went, what our mistakes were. It was a very open environment where we could talk about what we did wrong, what the rest of the team did wrong, very sanctity and, you know, a room of high sanctity where what said in that room stays in that room. And then more importantly, lessons learned, what we were going to fix the next time. But with the human factors debrief, what I say is, and it was actually an acronym I use, and this is not my acronym. I got this from the human factors world. The PEAR model, P-E-A-R. And P stands for person. So whenever we look at a task or we want to look at a certain outcome, look at the person. The P means let's look at our people, who was involved, psychological aspects, psychosocial aspect, the physical aspect of the environment, you know, were the right team members on the team. So we're just looking at the people first. Then we look at the environment. Now, if you're in some kind of environment where the physical environment is a factor, look at that. But really, a lot of times in organizations, we're looking at the regulatory environment, the market environment, the economy, maybe the environment in our own organization. What are some culture issues in our organization maybe affected this? So that's the E. And the next is the action. That's the actual action that was taken. So what were the decisions that were made? What was the training involved? What were the skill sets that we lacked when we made these actions? So the actual action. Then you look at the R, the final one is resources. You know, were we provided the right resources? Did leadership step in for us? Did we have a lack of leadership? You know, what resources did we not have? What standard operating procedures could we have utilized more? But I think if you look at those four main areas, and this is not something you have to sit down and take a day to do. This could be done. You know, if you want to take an hour, be done as quick as, you know, on the back of a coffee napkin, just sit down with a colleague and talk 5 or 15 minutes. Hey, let's go over this real quick. The sales call didn't go well. Let's talk about these different aspects of why it didn't. But I think if you just take that deliberate step to get that human factors debrief and really think about those human factors, that's how you can start to make better decisions. It's how you can start to eliminate or not eliminate, but mitigate some of those human errors the next time you do those tasks. So that's a little more of a deliberate step, but again, a good way to kind of, you know, force yourself and your teams to really look at these human factors aspects.
That's great. So just in our last few moments here, Brandon, if you could only say one thing to a young person who is stepping into their first leadership role in an organization, what would you say to them? What would be your words of wisdom?
Three words: humble, approachable, credible. Humble, approachable, credible. I don't think there's ever been on the face of this earth since the beginning of time the perfect leader, nor do I think there ever will be. But I think if you look at one of the best ways I hear this all the time, like how do you describe the perfect leader or how do you decide the ideal leader? And this is something we used to use in the Air Force and the fighter pilot world to describe our ideal instructor. And it was humble, approachable, credible, humble. You know, even though you may be very experienced and you may be one of the best at your job and you do very well, you always stay humble. Everybody loves a humble leader.
Yeah.
Approachable, kind of along the same line, being humble. Even though you may, you know, be in that position of authority, you may have a very good record. You don't want to be in the ivory tower. You know, you don't want to be the person that people are afraid to come talk to, because who was Colin Powell was famous for saying, you know, a leader's job is to fix the problems of their people. And the day they stop coming to you with their problems is the day you stop being their leader, because either they assume you don't care anymore, or they just assume there's nothing you can do about it, either of which is very bad. So approachable, because a leader's job, I completely agree with that quote, is to solve those problem or help solve those problems of their people, of their teams. And they should be able to approach you with that. And if they're not, you know, something's wrong. If nobody's coming to you with problems and you think everything's great, then trust me, everything's not great. And then
Yeah,
finally, and then
is it? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, go, and then finally is credible. Because, hey, you can be the leader, but if you don't have an idea, or you have no technical knowledge whatsoever of what your frontline people are doing, or you know, you have gotten to that position for whatever reason that's not a valid reason, or you know, people know it, and you're not the one that you don't lead by example. You're not the first, you know, you in other words, I always say in leadership, never ask your people to do something that you're not willing to do yourself. So credible. Don't be afraid to take out the trash sometimes, whether it's, you know, literally or figuratively.
Right.
And it's not about you necessarily helping someone. Yes, of course you have people take out the trash, but it's about the people seeing you do that. It's about the people seeing you getting out there. And you know, you're not afraid to do that. You're not afraid to go out and do the tasks they do. So humble, approachable, credible. I think that sums up the best way. If you had to strive for one idea, I think that's it, if you could try to sum it up.
Thank you. Hey, thank you so much for this conversation. I've enjoyed it. I've learned a lot. And I have to say that for me, the military experience is completely outside of my
No.
whole realm of knowledge. And it's great, talking to you and learning from you.
Well,
So.
thanks, Bella. I sure do appreciate it, and I appreciate you having me on and our connection, and love to talking to you more, and keep collaborating.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, Bella.
This is Bella Engelbach, and I'd like to thank Brandon Williams for being my guest on The Edges of Lean. You can find Brandon at lead-tac.com, that is LEAD-TAC.com. What overlaps did you hear between your definition of lean thinking and Brandon's view of leadership? Please join me in exploring more of The Edges of Lean. There's a lot to learn. The Edges of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelberg. This is a Lean for Humans production.